The Gemara in Avodah Zarah brings down two classic examples of kafui tov, of being lacking gratitude, of being unappreciative. The first example, says Gemara, is as follows. When Adam Rishon was given one mitzvah, that mitzvah was not to eat from Eitz Hadas. Chava was tempted by the Nachash. Chava took that very fruit, gave it to Adam, and in fact, Adam ate from the Eitz Hadas. When Hashem saw that Adam ate from this Eitz Hadas, what Hashem did was entered into conversation very gently with Adam to allow him the opportunity to recognize that he did wrong. But what did Adam do? Instead of recognizing his mistake, he said, "Aisha shenasati madi, that woman that you gave me, you gave her to me as a helpmate, and you gave her to be an assistant to me. Quite the opposite, she was my ruination, she was my trouble." Says the Gemara, he was kafui b'tov. Rashi points out that in fact was the first example of a person being kafui tov. Then the Gemara says that this became a trait in the human race, and in fact the second example of this was at Kabbalah Satorah. When the Jewish nation were at Har Sinai, they reached a pinnacle, a tremendous height of seeing Hashem's glory, recognizing Hashem's presence, and in that state, Hashem said the words, "Mi yitein," who would give that the Klal Yisrael should remain at this level? Who would give that they should always be here? And apparently that was a tviya, there was a complaint against the Jewish nation. Had we said the words, "Atatitein," Hashem, you give, Hashem, you provide us that help, you give us that push, apparently that would have made the difference, and it might well have been that Hashem would have delivered us right then onto a very much different path. But we didn't say those words. Says the Gemara, we were kafui tov. And both of these Gemaras, and both of these examples are rather difficult to understand. And I'd like to share with you why each is difficult. The first one doesn't seem to have much to do with kafui tov at all. Kafui tov means if I do something for you, I expect you to be appreciative, and I expect you to have at least a sense of gratitude. Now what Adam did was a serious mistake. Hashem gave him a helpmate, and then he messed up. He blew it, and he ate from the Eitz Hadas. When Hashem appeared to him, Hashem gave him the opportunity to admit his guilt, to do tshuva, and he would have been accepted back. He made a poor choice. He acted in a small-minded way. He started playing the blame game. That woman, she was my problem. She caused me to sin. What he did was clearly silly. What he did was unintelligent. But it was not a lack of a karas hatov. What he did was he tried to get out of the blame. He felt that he was caught red-handed. And he felt that he was trapped. What he tried to do was slide out of it by pushing the guilt off onto somebody else. Ha'isha shenasati madi. That woman that you gave me for my good, I trusted in her. Hashem, didn't you recognize she was given to me for my good? I understood that she was really for my benefit. I trusted her because you told me to. That woman that you gave me for my good, because I trusted in her, she ended up being the problem. Again, not smart, not humble, not completely honest, but it really doesn't seem to be much to do with hakaras hatov, with recognizing the good, with appreciation. But what's even worse, and the second example is even far more difficult to understand. You see, Tosas explains that the Jewish nation went through a very careful calculation. They wanted to say the words, "Hashem, you should give." They were at the pinnacle, the height of that which a human can reach. And at that point, Hashem said, "Who would give that you should live like this forever?" And the Jewish nation said, if we say the words, "Hashem, you should give it," they recognize that they would have been indebted to Hashem. They recognize that they would add to their debt. They didn't want to add to that debt anymore, so they didn't say it. Now that is not a lack of appreciation. That's an interesting calculation, but they didn't lack hakaras hatov. See, hakaras hatov means if you did something for me, I don't appreciate it. But all they did was they didn't want to be further in debt. If I don't want to borrow money, that means I don't want to borrow more money. But kafui tov means if I've borrowed money already, I owe money, and I don't want to pay back. Here what they were doing was they said, I don't want to get more into debt. Hashem, we owe you enough already. We don't want to be further indebted. That doesn't seem to have anything to do with kafui tov. Yet again, the Gemara says both of these are examples of lacking in gratitude. And both of these are examples of not being appreciative. And the question is, what's pshat in these Gemaras? And to answer that, I'd like to focus on an interesting exhibit in the Bronx Zoo. If you go to the Bronx Zoo, you'll see the silverback gorillas. Now, the silverback gorilla is a hulking, powerful animal. And if you look at it closely enough, you may see certain resemblance to a human. As a matter of fact, if you travel among certain types of people, you see a very close resemblance, and you may even, Taka, not wonder so much about the theory of evolution. But be it as it may, the silverback gorilla acts in a very human-like manner. The head gorilla, the alpha, the one male in the pack, is the boss. There's a harem, many female, many children, one single dominant male. And that's very important to understand. He is the king. And not only is he the king, he's oftentimes makes the appearance of being a good father. You'll see him watching the little boys, gorillas, as they play. And if they get too rambunctious, if there's too much roughhouse, he steps in, and he doesn't step in, he stomps all hundreds of pounds of him in, and they run for their life. But he keeps order, he keeps control, and as a matter of fact, he demonstrates very good parenting skills to the point where they've even found examples where if a child is lost, the male, alpha male, will cry, he'll mourn, he'll seem to be despondent over the loss of his children. And you see something that looks like human behavior. Until an interesting thing happens. When his little cubs, his lovingly dear children, turn mature, when they hit that point when they're also capable of reproduction, he is no longer the kind, gentle father. He becomes a wild, vicious killer. And if they don't remove the children quickly enough, he will destroy them. And that kind, gentle, considerate father becomes very, very different. You'll find this in the wild oftentimes. The mother tiger will literally give her life for her cubs until they reach 2 years of age, and then she will turn on them. If they do not escape her clutches by the time they're fully mature, she will literally rip them from limb to limb. The same mother who is so devoted, the same mother who went out daily to kill so that she could provide the milk for her cubs, the same mother who stood over her babies to protect them, the minute they reach a certain stage, she turns and she no longer recognizes them and they no longer recognize her. And the reason for that is, in the animal soul, in the Nefesh HaBahami, there's no zikaron, there's no memory. You see, the animal soul is instinctive, it's pure appetites, pure desires, whatever Hashem programmed into that is what it is. Hashem programmed into the gorilla the sense of taking care of the young until they reach a certain point. Once that natural instinct stops, they are opponents, they are competitors, and the gorilla will fight one against the other. So too throughout much of the animal kingdom. The human is quite different. If you go to the worst neighborhood in the world, do not insult somebody's mother. Because whether they mean it or not, you'll hear that line, "Who are you talking about, my mother?" And the reality is, amongst the lowest caliber of society, there is an affinity, there's an attachment. The mother will take care of a child under almost all circumstances. The mother will care for the child. And even if the child is rotten to the core, the parents, to some extent, will look out for them. And certainly the child, at some level, feels an appreciation and feels an attachment back, because the human is distinct from the animal kingdom. However, there's one more critical distinction between the animal world and the human. And that is, the animal world typically is broken up into two categories. There's chaya and there's behema. Roughly translated as domesticated and wild animals. A chaya, a wild animal, is unfriendly, is not comfortable within man's proximity, and cannot be subjugated. A behema, a domesticated animal, is a type of animal that's very comfortable within the proximity of man, and typically man can convert that animal into a beast of burden. That animal will serve dutifully and obey a very particular order. Provided the man takes care of him in a specific way, that animal will be loyal and dutiful. There's chaya, there's behema, and then there's man. You see, man is very strange. You could take a 1,500-pound horse and you could have it obey your command with a snap of a finger, the command of the voice. Man can subjugate and control a behemoth. Man oftentimes acts that way. There are many times when the human acts as if he is a behemoth in the sense that he's subjugated by others. He can be literally walked down a path and made to act in a very particular way. But then something happens. That subjugated man, that enslaved man, has a certain welling up of pride within him, and he proclaims the words, "Give me liberty or give me death." And throughout history, you'll find men who are enslaved, who will literally give their life for something as lofty as freedom, rights. People will willingly go to their death for very, very interesting things. And I want you to hear something very, very critical. The human is comprised of two separate dimensions. There's a nefesh habahami, an animal instinctive part of the human, and there's another part of the human. When the man screams out, "Give me liberty or give me death," you know what his nefesh habahami says? "What are you, crazy? What do I need liberty for? I have a nice place to sleep. I have food to eat. Why are you bothering me? So I have to work, so I'll work." But there's another part of the human that screams out. And that other part of the human denies being subjugated and defies ever being shackled. But that part is not the nefesh habahami. That's a very different part of the human. That part of the human is the nefesh ha-sichli, and the intellect, the pure neshama that wants all that's good, all that's proper. And that part of the human can never be shackled. However, throughout history, when you see man constantly giving up his freedom, constantly being enslaved, and constantly serving others, it's because he's lost that spark, he's lost that understanding, and his nefesh habahami comes to the fore. The Derech Hashem explains to us that Adam, the way Hashem created Adam, is very different than you and I. Derech Hashem explains that when Hashem originally created man, Hashem made this human to be so superior, to be so brilliant, and to be so in control of himself that he almost could not identify with the Yetzer Hara. The Derech Hashem explains to us that Adam Rishon didn't have Bechira as we have. He says Ra, anything bad, was so distant from him that it would be akin to putting his hand in a fire. Granted, in theory, he could do that which is wrong, but he had such a clarity of mind, he had such a brilliant understanding that he never would do anything wrong. Why? Because he recognized it as damaging, he recognized it as self-inflicted harm, and he never would do it. However, Adam did one thing. When he ate from the Eitz Hadas, he radically changed himself and the creation. See, it wasn't just that he violated a mitzvah. It wasn't just that he ate this fruit that he wasn't supposed to eat. He ingested Ra into him. He changed the very nature of the human. He changed the very form that he existed in. And now he became this murky, confused sort of existence that we today are. Meaning the clarity, the brilliant understanding, the absolute vision was lost. And now, when you wake up in the morning and one day you feel like learning and the next day you don't, and one day you really literally speak to Hashem as if Hashem is literally present, and 5 minutes later you're gone, what you're experiencing is bringing the Yetzer Hara into the human, ingesting it. You're experiencing Adam after the sin. And that, my friends, is very different than Adam was before the sin. One more step. If you ask social scientists today, they would tell you the most you could afford to have as a family is 1.2 children. And the reason for that is quite obvious. The cost of a child from the time of birth till about 18, they now estimate, is $250,000. So, assuming that you're making an average wage, assuming that you're earning what the average human being in our society will earn, you could afford 1.2 children, give or take a little percentage point here or there. Now, that's a very critical thing to think about, because I'd like to share with you a conversation I had with a 17-year-old fellow, and here's how it went. Basically, this fellow was discussing whether he should do something or shouldn't do something. My father wants me to do this, but I don't want to do it. And I asked him, why not? Well, I'll tell you the truth, if I do such and such, I'm going to be, I'm going to be beholden to my father. I don't want to owe my father anything. I mentioned this previously in a Kibarava Aim Shmuz, if you remember. I wanted to grab this fellow by the shirt collars. You don't want to owe your father anything. You are 17 years too late. In whose bed did you sleep? In whose house did you live? Whose food did you eat? And the reality is that the typical teenager is what we call a kafui tov. A kafui tov is one who totally eradicates, totally forgets, totally doesn't even remember the good done. I don't want to owe my father anything implies that up until this point, I'm debt free. Up until this point, I don't owe my father anything. If I take this favor from him, then I'm going to change. I'm going to be an eved. I'm going to owe my father anything. And that makes me uncomfortable because right now I am debt free. I owe my father nothing. I've received nothing from him. And I'm very comfortable in this position. And what you quickly recognize is that the human has a very strange ability to forget the entire history of his existence. And here's the point. If you wonder what part of the human is able to forget the history, it is not the nefesh ha-sichli. You see, there's a part of me that remembers every detail of every conversation I ever had in my life. There's a full half of me that's totally alert, totally cognizant, and totally conscious. That part forgets nothing. However, I'm in this mixed up state. I'm half seichel, half behema, and in this mixed up, confused state, everything is sort of whatever. And in this murky mire of my consciousness, I'm able to forget many things. Hence, a 17-year-old is able to say the words, I don't want to owe my father anything. And I believe that answers our second question. You see, Tosas explained, the Jewish nation said, of course we would ask Hashem to give. Of course we'd ask Hashem to give us that level for eternity, but we don't want to owe Hashem anything. But you know what that means? What that means is they eradicated everything that was done up until that point for them. If I understood that Hashem created me, Hashem gives me life, Hashem gives me air to breathe, Hashem gives me the food to eat, Hashem gave me everything that I have been given, I would understand that I have a tremendous debt to Hashem that I can never pay back. But if they said the words, we don't want to say atah titein because we don't want to be in debt to Hashem, what that means is they eradicated the entire past of their life. That is the ultimate kafui tov, and I believe that that is exactly pshat in Adam. You see, what Adam received from Hashem was a tremendous gift, a helpmate, an ezer kenegdo who was to be his partner in everything that he did. There is a part of Adam that understood that, there's a part of Adam that so recognized that, and there's a part of Adam that fully appreciated that. That part of Adam could never speak negatively about his wife. That part can never say, that woman, you gave her to me for my good and really she's for my detriment. But what Adam did when he ate from the Eitz Hadas was he changed himself. He ingested within himself a nefesh abahami. He made himself much more physical. And now in this murky state, he could forget the past. Now that he could forget the past, there was an easy excuse. Hashem, that woman that you gave me as a helpmate, she wasn't for my good, she was for my bad. But you see, those words he could never have uttered had he had a clarity of thought, because if his mind was clear, all he could see was the good that she was for him, and all that he could feel was a tremendous sense of Hakaras HaTov. You see, there is a part of me that fully appreciates everything that's ever done for me. That's my seichel. If you ever did me the slightest favor, there's a part of me that only wants to pay back everything that you've done for me, and there's nothing that can prevent me from wanting to pay you that back. The only way I'm not going to feel gratitude is if I can eradicate history. If the nefesh ha-bahami, if that murky, dark side of me gets a hold of me, and now I no longer see what you've done for me, I no longer remember it, I've eradicated that past, so then there's no sense of appreciation because you haven't done anything for me. But once I have in my mind's eye a clarity of what you've done for me, I can't help but pay you back. The only way that Adam could possibly have denied the good is because he totally obliterated that which was good. Because had he seen it for what it was, he would have had an overwhelming sense of appreciation. He would have wanted to pay her back. And therefore he can never have said, that woman that you gave me, she wasn't for my good. That came because he was kafui tov. That came because he put that part in him. And that came from the Nefesh HaBahami. Now, that being said, I'd like to share with you a very interesting observation. The Mesillas Yesharim tells us that the Yesod HaChassidus, the absolute bedrock foundation of everything we do in our entire religion, is one concept. Understanding that Hashem created me, gave me a few years on this planet, and exactly what I shape myself into is what I'll be for eternity. Says in the Mesillas Yesharim, that is the basis of everything we do, the bedrock foundation of our religion, and without that you have nothing. If so, you might be pondering a very curious question. If that's the basis of our religion, the foundation, why is it not mentioned in the Torah? From Bereshis and Bara to Einei Kol Yisrael, there's not a mention of Olam Haba, Tchiyas HaMeisim, anything. It's all not there. And if it's so basic and so much the foundation, how's it shayach that the Torah doesn't speak about it at length? And the Chovos Levavos asked this question, and interesting enough, he provides a number of answers. And one answer that the Chovos Levavos says is as follows. The reason why the Torah does not talk about Olam Haba is because you might make a mistake. He says, you might think that if you do mitzvahs, you're therefore entitled to reward, and it's not so simple. You might assume that if you learn Torah, daven, do what you're supposed to, you'll have a chelik in Olam Haba, you'll have a portion in the world to come, and it's not so simple that you will, therefore the Torah did not write it because it's not so pashut. And then he explains what he means. He says, because there's a cheshbon, there's a balance. You see, what Hashem gives to you is everything that you could ever need. Hashem gives you your body, your mind, your talents, your abilities, your capacity. Everything that you are was given to you. The land on which you walk, the food that you eat, the air that you breathe, you are constantly, constantly a recipient. And if Hashem would ever enter into a strict din, everything that you could do in your entire life would not begin to repay Hashem 1/10, 10,000th of what He's given to you. Therefore, the Torah does not write that you get schar and olam haba because it's not so pashut. You've been receiving, receiving, receiving. It may well be that all of your mitzvahs, all of your Torah learning, everything that you've done does not begin to come close to owing Hashem. Therefore, says Chovos Levavos, a recommendation is that you're matzdik as a rabbim. He recommends, and we discussed this in Shmuel 17, acquiring Olam Haba the easy way, that he says it is a very wise man who gets others on his payroll. By getting other Jews to do mitzvahs, by bringing others along, he says that it makes it much more likely, and therefore you'll get chayim, you'll get chesed in the eyes of Hashem, and Hashem will usher you into Gan Eden, into a beautiful portion. But here's the point. The point that he's making is that we walk around with the understanding that basically everything I'm doing for Hashem, and basically Hashem owes me an awful lot. But there's a full half of the equation that we don't focus in on, and that is that I'm the constant recipient of good. My entire life, my entire existence has been given to me, and all I do all day long is receive, 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 and that part is ne'alam, is forgotten from the human. And a guy stands in Shemona Esrei and says the words, of course, Hashem, I would thank you. And I'd be the most appreciative person in the world, but what have you given me? What do I have to thank you for? My arms, my legs, my... Like, what are these arms aren't that good. I'm not exactly a marathon runner. What do I have to thank? I'm not that good looking. I'm not that powerful. I'm not that rich. I should thank you? I mean, if you give me something, I would thank you. But, like, basically, my life stinks, and, like, what should I thank you for? And as strange as that sounds, you'll have many, many people who say the words of Nishmas, and they're about to say the words, Hashem, if my arms would stretch out like the birds, if my eyes were as brilliant as the sun, and they say, what? I should thank Hashem? What did Hashem ever do for me? And if you'd like to understand how that is possible, the answer really is quite simple. I am comprised of two very distinct parts. There's a part of me that understands it totally and completely. I get it. I have a huge sense of appreciation. Everything that I'm the recipient of, I can't begin to pay back. But in the murky waters of the eye, the nefesh habahami comes in, it focuses, it's there, and I can't see it, I can't remember it, and I don't begin to remember anything that's done for me. It's not a lack of appreciation, I don't see it, I don't recognize it, it's not there. And I think that this is a curable issue. And I'll share with you how this is something that can be cured. I once mentioned a book that I didn't mention the name of who, but the storyline went as follows. A young boy when he was 3 years of age was in an accident and was blinded. When he was 40 years of age, a doctor felt that he could correct the issue. And in fact, he went through a procedure, and at 40 years of age, he regained his sight. And there are pages and pages in the book that describe what it was like when he walked into the waiting room, now that he was sighted, and sat down in a chair and was mesmerized by what he saw, the colors, the depth. He described the carpet. His wife, who was with him, explained to him the difference between a square and a triangle. And then he finally looked at the carpet and he said, "What's that?" And she said, "It's a paisley." And he said, "But it's swimming. It's moving. What is it?" She said, "It's a shape." And he said the words, "How is it possible that there are all these people in the waiting room and they're not dancing with joy looking at this vibrant activity called the paisley?" And the pleasure that this human being had in that one moment was probably something we could never begin to understand. However, that pleasure is something that Hashem designed for us. And that pleasure is something that we can experience if we train ourselves to sense it, if we train ourselves to see it. And I have a little musar exercise that I think goes a long way to help us appreciate the gifts that we have that we never really focus on. You see, I have remarkable gifts. I have arms, I have legs, I have sight, I have hearing. I have tremendous, tremendous gifts. It's not that I'm not the recipient of much good. It's that I don't even see it. Of course, if I would see it for a moment, I'd feel such a sense of appreciation. I'd sing shir v'shevach v'hodol l'borei to my Creator, but I don't see it. And I have a musar exercise that I think may help to see it a little bit more. The next time you have some time on your hand, you can do a very chashuv mitzvah called visiting the old age home. And this is a very chashuv mitzvah because it's pure chesed. And just your presence there, I'd bring my kids, especially in Rochester, we were regulars at the old age home there. And when you see the smiles on older people's face, when they see innocent little children, you bring real joy, you bring real nachas. And that's a big mitzvah. But while you're there, you could accomplish something else. Look around. The way it worked in Rochester is the lower floors were the more mobile, the more put together people. And you see Mrs. Edelstein, fine woman, big smile on her face. The only thing is, unfortunately, Mrs. Edelstein is in a wheelchair and cannot get out of it. Because that little cartilage in her knee just sort of wore out. And nothing really wore as much as the lubricant in the cartilage. And she just can't walk. Cannot walk. Cannot walk. And cannot get out of that chair. Needs an aide to help her in and out of the chair. For the rest of her life, she's locked into that chair. Okay. And you go a little further down, you see Mr. Cohn. Nice man, very verbal, very articulate. But he's forever, for the rest of his life, will have to walk around with an oxygen tank. Why? Something in his lungs, not clear what, but the air we breathe is only 21% oxygen. It's not enough. He can't extract enough oxygen. For the rest of his life, he's going to walk around with a tank. Wherever he goes, he carries that tank with him. He's mobile, he can walk. He has a little thing over here, and he's walking around with a tank. You go a little further, and you see Mr. Goldstein. Now, Mr. Goldstein gets to go on trips 3 times a week. 3 times a week, Mr. Goldstein gets to go on trips where they take him out of the home. Now, isn't that nice? But then you find out that the trips that he goes on is to a dialysis center. And then you discover that there are things in the body that purify your blood. His liver, different organs that purify the blood, and for some reason, his aren't functioning. And for some reason, the normal processes are not being done, and for that reason, 3 times a week, literally, his blood has to be taken out of his body, filtered to remove the dead blood cells and other impurities, and put back into his body. All right, listen, it's all right, it's life, what are you going to do? Then you see Mr. Eckstein. Mr. Eckstein is full and mobile, no oxygen, no dialysis, Everything's perfect, except you find out that he needs depends. You see, he really can't control his bowel movement, and he's wearing a diaper, but he's not a kid. He's 75 years old, and it doesn't smell so great all the time, but he really can't do anything about it. And think about that the next time, you know, you're in a business meeting. You don't wear diapers. You don't have those kind of problems. But you see, that floor is really the mobile floor where people are still put together. Go up to the next level and you see a little bit different situation. You see Mrs. Kramer. Mrs. Kramer says, "So nice to meet you. So 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 nice to meet you." Over and over and over for hours on end. And then you'll come back a half hour later. "So nice to meet you. So nice to meet you. So nice to meet you." And then you see Mr. Mel. Mr. Mel is drooling. But he's not just drooling because he's drooling. He's drooling because he's lost all motor control. And he slips, when he flips over, there's nothing he can do to bring his body straight back up. They have to strap him into the chair. And all you have to do is spend a half hour in this environment and say to yourself, "Oh my goodness, I am the most blessed, rich individual in the world. Do you know what I have? Ashiras. My arms work, my shoulders work, my hips work, my bowels are controlled. I'm able to control my tongue. I'm able to go about this business called life with such ease, with such comfort that it's baffling." And it's at that point you reach your very core cognition. It's not that we're not the recipients of much good, it's that there are these huge blocks that stop me from seeing it. There's this heaviness, this murkiness in my mind's consciousness that doesn't allow me to recognize all that I've received, all that I'm constantly receiving. Hence, I don't feel a tremendous sense of Akar Satov. But all of that has been delivered to me. And here's one of the most powerful points the Chovas Levavos says. He says, this is the underpinnings of our religion. One of the most powerful forces that a Jew should utilize to better serve his Creator is to wake up in the morning, open his eyes and say, "Wow, Hashem, look what you've given to me. Am I deserving of it? Have I accomplished with it? Have I done what I should? No. But look what you've given to me." And that should bring a person to such a powerful sense of Akar Satov that he should sing out and serve his Creator with that huge sense of joy, enjoyment, and be a very lofty individual. My friends, if you want to be wealthy, I have a formula for poverty. All you have to do is set your sight at the acquirement of physical possessions, set your sights upon the acquirement of money, and you'll be poor for the rest of your life. If you'd like to enjoy your stay on the planet, train yourself in appreciating that which you have. But to do that, you have to do something very lofty and very holy. You have to stop being a behemoth. You have to stop allowing that part of me to block my sight, that part of me to stop me from remembering. You have to remember that which others have done for you. You have to write this down on an index card. If you're having trouble with your parents, and who doesn't have trouble with his parents? If you're having trouble with your parents, sit down and take stock. By the way, when I was learning in Rochester as a bocher, and I would go home for an out Shabbos, every single out Shabbos before I'd go home, I'd learn the Gemara in Kiddushin about Kibbutz Av V'Em. And not that we had a bad relationship, Baruch Hashem had a beautiful relationship with my parents. But when you start reading that Gemara, you start appreciating how much your parents have done for you. And you start appreciating how much you owe them. But unless you review that, unless you take stock of that, it's forgotten. It's just not there. And if you'd like to raise your level of humanity, if you'd like to be a higher functioning human being, you have to take stock. You have to take inventory of that which others have done for you. You have to remember the good that your mother did for you, the good that your father did for you. You have to remember the fact that I'm not a creator, I'm a creation. And you have to recognize all the good that's been done. And I believe that that's exactly what Chazal are telling us. And what the Klal Yisrael did at Har Sinai was a very foolish mistake. They eradicated history. They didn't want to say, "Hashem, you should give," because they didn't want to feel indebted. Chazal say, "Don't you understand? You are totally, completely, utterly indebted to Hashem. There's nothing you could be without Hashem. You only exist because of Hashem, and everything that you are is because of Hashem. Of course you owe. You're so deeply in debt that you have to understand there's nothing you could possibly do to deepen your debt. Ask, ask." The reason you don't ask is because you feel like you're a free man. You feel like you don't owe anything to anybody. but that came from Adam Arishon. And that came from Adam ingesting the Ra to be within him. What Adam did was he changed that clarity of thought. The reason that he was the first of the Kofi Tovs is because he said that woman, he forgot instantly when he ate from the Eitz Hadas, he instantly forgot the good that was given to him. He instantly obliterated that. Hence he said to Hashem, that what you gave to me isn't good. That changed the form of humanity, and that's something that affects us to this very day. To change in this requires thinking, requires understanding, and requires focusing on the difference between a behemoth and a human. A behemoth is completely instinctual, completely natural. It does whatever its instincts drive it to. The human has a very different part to it, and the human has a part that completely, totally remembers and focuses in a very different way. I'd like to close with one last observation. This Shabbos, at about 4:30, the lights went out in Muncie. Just like that. Muncie is a rural area. The grid was never really developed for the type of population that's now there. And oftentimes, especially during a rainstorm, the grid goes out, the electricity is gone, and everything goes black. My kids are used to it already. Charlotte Schultz is very cute, singing, because in the dark, singing is very nice, etc. Okay, fine. It happens to be, I went to Mincha, because it was raining, I went to a Hasidic shtibel not far from my house. And Mincha was a bit of a challenge, because you see, no lights. Now you could daven if you know Shemoneh Esrei by heart, or you can daven Ashrei by heart, but how do you lane? You can't lane if you can't see the letters. You're not Yotzei. You have to see the letters to lane. Happens to be that the Chazan was able to daven, and they were able to lane. Why? Again, it was a Hasidic minyan, and they had the habit, minug, of lighting two candles by the front, and those kerosene candles stay lit the whole Shabbos. And so the Chazan was able to daven, they brought over the Sefer Torah, put it on a table, as opposed to the Bima, everybody was able to yosei, very nice. Now here's the observation. You know why there's a minug that there should be two candles in the front? Because in any shtibel in Europe, in the 1800s, 1700s, 1500s, the way you provided light was quite simple. You lit a candle. As a matter of fact, Ner L'Maor, if someone wanted to donate something to the Beis Medrash so that others could learn, he'd donate a Ner, a candle. The whole concept of a Yortzeit candle is because people wanted there to be an Ilui Neshama. They wanted to give the Neshama a Schus. If I light a candle in a Beis Medrash, people will be able to learn, people will be able to daven. That's a Schus. It's a merit for the Nifter. Now here is a very simple observation. If you were the richest guy in Poland, and you had wealth that was astounding, you would have a candelabra in the center of your dining room that held maybe 100 candles. And you would have servants to light those candles for you. Little me, with a flick of my switch, I put on that candelabra in the middle of my dining room, and I don't have 100 candles, I have 500 candles, maybe 1,000 candlelight at the flick of a switch. What that means in plain, simple language is the most poor, impoverished human being in our society enjoys wealth that previous generations couldn't imagine, yet we don't feel it. Me, rich? I mean, I'm going to have problems paying my bills. I'm not rich. But that's exactly the point. You see, there's a part of me that never gets it, never appreciates it, never recognizes it. No matter how much you give that part, it's ever going to be hungry and ever going to forget. But the human, to remain and be holy, has to focus, has to remember, has to understand things, has to train himself to appreciate. And when I do that, then there's a part of me that instantaneously, automatically, has a sense of how could I not pay back the good that's done for me? And when a person does that, they love their parents, they love their spouse, they love their children, they're appreciative. When people do things for you and you recognize it, you enjoy their company, you recognize the good, you love them for what they've done for you, you're a happy person. But if not, you're a miserable creature. And more than anything, if you don't train yourself to see the good, you can never serve your Creator because you don't recognize that which He's done for you and you don't understand the good. May Hashem grant us the wisdom, understanding, ability to put this into practice.